My guest today on Takes on the World, Stephen Snegoski, earned his doctorate in American history with a focus on American foreign policy at the University of Maryland. His attention to the neoconservative involvement in American foreign policy predates September 11th, and his first major work on the subject, The War in Iraq, Conceived in Israel, was published February 10, 2003, more than a month before the American attack. He is the author of The Transparent Cabal, The Neoconservative Agenda, War in the Middle East, and the National Interest of Israel, about which I interviewed him in 2008. Welcome back, Stephen Snegoski, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much for having me back, Jeff.
I'm glad you're here, or there. Both you and I predicted that Chuck Hagel would face a tough grilling when he went before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and that he would bend over backward to please his critics. But did you expect it to be as harsh and disrespectful as it was?
No, I don't. I think it went beyond what I had expected. And I think that's one reason why the major Israel lobby groups like AIPAC weren't in the forefront here.
Well, it seems that, you know, getting back to the neocons, when some of the Jewish groups, and I say Jewish groups because the Jewish establishment was pretty much united against Hagel's nomination, and the Jewish press was filled with articles and means to stop it. But the neocons led the charge, and kind of, I guess, AIPAC's excuse was that they have to deal with who's ever the Secretary of Defense, and so they let other organizations within the Zionist network do the hatchet job. But the question, you know, is that he was... I have to admit, John McCain was quoted on NPR this morning as saying it was one of the worst performances ever for a candidate for a presidential appointment before the Senate committee, and I had to agree with that. It was as if Hagel was totally unprepared for the question he was going to receive.
That's true, but I'm not sure if Hagel is well-versed in lying and obfuscation.
He certainly didn't prove it as the senators who grilled him were. You know, I was thinking, I mentioned before I called you, when Lindsey Graham asked him to name one senator who had been intimidated by the Israel lobby, that was a time for Hagel to say, "Me, sir, and I'm intimidated right now." And one dumb thing that the Israel lobby had the Congress do was start the Iraq War. What do you think the response would have been if he had said
well,
that?
Well, I think the response to that would be he would be telling the truth, but he would not become Secretary of Defense.
Now we have Senator Inhofe has pledged that he is going. He wasn't going to make a fight on the committee, but on the floor of the Senate, he plans to filibuster, literally to have people go there and delay this vote until what he claims the pro-Israel Democrats are forced to recognize that Hagel is an enemy of Israel. So we may see such a prolonged fight on this. And obviously the Republicans have not shown any willingness to concede anything to President Obama after the election, that he may end up not being appointed.
Well, my understanding is the 60 votes prevent a filibuster. I mean, can overcome it in the Senate, and there's over 60 votes apparently now.
Well, it'll be interesting to see that when the pressure starts building on senators. I mean, recall Charles Percy having his arm twisted by Ronald Reagan in 1981 to support AWACS. Reconnaissance planes for Saudi Arabia over the wishes of AIPAC, and when Charles Percy, senator from Illinois, switched his vote, the lobby made him pay, and we have Dick Durbin in there as a result. So we haven't seen the extent of pressure, but given Hegel's poor performance, it's a pretty dicey whether they will actually have 60 votes. I mean, there are a couple of Republicans who said they will support him, but that's at this present time.
There are two, I believe.
Right.
But to stop him with a filibuster, a number of Republicans have said, including McCain, at least as of yesterday, were saying they would not stop it on the filibuster part. And after that, I think you only need a majority vote. You know, for up or down, do you want him as Secretary of Defense? It's that filibuster. You have to overcome the 60 on the filibuster aspect. Apparently there are some Republicans who would, like McCain, who would vote against him, who say they will not support, will allow a vote.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, because he and his old buddies, certainly Lindsey Graham would support the filibuster, and even though he's leaving, we have Joe Lieberman to whisper in McCain's ear. But you actually, one of the big questions, and you wrote about this the day before the hearing, why would Obama appoint someone as controversial as Hegel in the first place, knowing that there was going to be opposition? Of course, I don't think anyone could have anticipated the viciousness in which Hegel was attacked in that hearing. But you wrote about the importance of Hegel to Obama's positions on Iran, so perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Right. Well, in my article, I put a great emphasis on Hegel's connection with the leading members of the traditional establishment, such as Scowcroft and Brzezinski, people of that ilk, that by bringing Hegel in, that Obama basically wants to avoid war with Iran. Now, he's going to need some support, or at least somebody to go to blame this on, to provide him with that advice. And so that's why he looks to someone with such as Hegel. And as I said, he would have the support from the traditional foreign policy establishment, which is wary of going to war with Iran, which they feel would be quite devastating for a number of reasons, including its terrible impact on the world economy. So, as I also tried to point out, it wouldn't be simply Hegel giving that advice to Obama, but also that he would allow the military brass to speak. And they, in the past, have expressed opposition to making a war on Iran. So it won't simply be Hegel saying these things. He will allow the military leaders to express their opposition, which should suffice in at least I think in Obama's thinking here, if I can read it correctly, to justify an avoidance of war, as the neocons and the other parts of the Israel lobby beat the drums for war, that now Iran is going to have has nuclear capability.
Well, that actually is my opinion and opinion of a number of people, critics of the administration and U.S. policy, that it has been largely the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, that have kept us from going to war on Iran to this point, a war that the neocons have been pushing since they got the war in Iraq. But not in this particular case, you have the whole American Jewish establishment, American Jewish Committee, and so on, the foreign policy arm of the lobby pushing, and as well as the think tanks, which are part of this Zionist network in Washington. But do you think after his performance at the hearings that they will let him alone? It's like they will watch every step, every statement he makes, and like some hyenas or jackals pick off the weakest of the a lot of herd of gazelles or deer, that they will keep focusing on Hegel rather than attacking those in the Pentagon and the former foreign policy elite like Zabrinsky and so on and Scowcroft, who are less vulnerable to their attacks.
Oh, I think they'll definitely do that. You know, that's one reason why I think that AIPAC didn't go all out, to at least, you know, openly, and use all of their resources to try to defeat him. That they felt, even if he gets in, we can take care of him, and he might be too fearful to really push these positions, or maybe Obama would say, well, geez, you know, this could be too dangerous for me. Though at the same time, from his State of Union address and also his inaugural address, he does want to focus on domestic affairs, domestic reform, and so certainly a war with Iran would certainly wreak havoc with his domestic policy goals.
My guest is Stephen Sagosky, author of Transparent Cabal and a recent article on Obama picking Chuck Hagel. One thing, however, that's going to be clear, we've seen in ads in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on, that Obama needs support from within the Democratic Party for his domestic agenda. He's not going to get it, obviously, from Republicans because they're still controlled largely by the Tea Party. But it's quite obvious that pressure is going to be brought on various Democrats to not go along with Obama's foreign policy on this. I mean, I recall that even before he had met with Netanyahu, when he was first elected, he had letters sent to him by three-quarters of the Senate and three-quarters of the Congress, members of Congress, telling him that when he meets with Netanyahu, not to put pressure on him. And obviously, now Obama has scheduled a trip eventually, now finally, to Israel on the 20th of March. And Netanyahu has already announced new housing starts in the West Bank. So Obama doesn't really have anybody at his back in Congress.
Well, you know, I was surprised, from the very beginning that fewer Democrats were willing to oppose him on the Hegel move. That in part, with Obama's popularity improving, many of these Democratic politicians may be fearful of antagonizing their base to go against Obama.
Well, actually, polls, and I've mentioned the program before, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs released a poll late August which showed that Americans really don't support Israel to that extent, that when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, whereas 30% Americans support Israel, 3% support the Palestinians, 65% say we should not take sides, which is extraordinary given the kind of pro-Israel propaganda that we hear every day and read every day in the U.S. media. And what's interesting is 58% said that if Israel is attacked by Iran, we should not go to the aid of Israel. So the base they're speaking of is the finance. They're trying to keep happy is the financial base that keeps the Democratic Party afloat.
Well, but I also think in terms of, you know, there are masses of regular Democrats who are sort of members of the Obama cult, and they wouldn't care much about the Palestinians or even the issue itself, but they could see this as a slap in the face of Obama. That here is, you know, appointment. This has been put front and center. I know just a lot of regular folks who are supporters of Obama talking about this, and they're quite critical of the opposition. Which, because AIPAC hasn't been front and center, some just these are the Republicans acting. Whereas if it becomes, hey, this isn't just the Republicans, this is the Israel. There really is an Israel lobby. You know, I think there is some fear of that happening, too, or even and for the politicians, too, to make it appear that they're too strong, too oriented towards Israel. Because, of course, if Schumer had opposed Hegel, that would have stopped the whole thing.
Yeah, Schumer, of course, is now under attack for not being pro-Israel enough. Of course, the Republicans are looking for any issue. They can no more care about Israel than they do helping immigrants from Mexico integrate themselves into the American economy. But it sounds good in front of the microphones because they know they have funders like Sheldon Adelson, who evidently spent a lot of money trying to block Hegel, as he spent a lot of money trying to block Obama.
But why do you think Schumer acted the way he did? I mean, don't you think there's a fear of going against Obama? This would hurt him politically.
I think Schumer and a number of other Jewish Democrats are really aware there's a potential risk to American Jews when the actions of Congress and the Senate prove that Pat Buchanan's statements about the Amen Corner are correct, and that sooner or later there will be a backlash on part of the American people, particularly if there's a war on Iran, and the economy, the world economy, goes into a deep pit, which many economists, analysts believe it would. There'd be one finger pointing at who was responsible, because there's only one sector of the American society has pushed for a war on Iran, an attack on Iran, and that includes the Christian Zionists, who are even more enthusiastic about it than the Jewish organization. So I think there's some fear on Schumer's part, and to go against a popular president, it would open a can of worms that I don't think he wants to go to. The other side is going to keep pushing, however, him on this.
Right, right. But it, you know, but so far, you know, I mean, he had his choice. He could have stopped them. So I don't think they're going to, now that it's going to be moving into the Senate floor, I don't think they're going, you know, I don't think they're going to stop him now. Now, will they criticize Hegel if he starts moving in that direction? Yes, I think they will maybe do, you know, do something like that once he becomes Secretary of Defense to try to prevent him from taking positions contrary to those they support, or at least not going very far in the opposite direction. So yes, I think that will be done, but not at the moment, though.
There's something else that occurred to me, that one of the reasons, even conceding, the other side conceding that Hegel will get the position, that their attack on him was a form of deterrence to show other members of the U.S. Congress, the House and the Senate, what is in store for them if they dare to criticize Israel. Recall Strobe Talbott, who was a senior editor of Time magazine back in 1981, and wrote a major article in which he concluded that Israel, a support of Israel by the United States, was a strategic liability. And then 14 years later, when Bill Clinton wanted him to be an undersecretary of state, came the lobby dragged this quote out, and Talbot had to tearfully recant, with Joe Biden standing on his side, that he was wrong, that Israel was not a liability, it was an asset, and so on. And Talbot now works for Brookings Institution, but he's never opened his mouth on the issue again. And I suspect no senator or member of Congress, most of whom have ambitions to stay in office or go even higher, are going to venture criticism of Israel after this hearing. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. But mentioning Talbot under Clinton, also Bobby Ray Inman got so scared he hightailed it back to Texas.
That was under Jimmy Carter.
No, that was under Clinton.
Under Clinton, okay.
1994.
Oh, yeah.
He was going to replace Les Aspin. was out.
That's right.
He was going to go in there. And then they brought up, he apparently, his sin apparently was Israel. He limited the information that Israel was to get back in the Reagan administration. This was when he was in the CIA. This was in the CIA when he
right.
was under Bill Casey. Apparently, Casey was on absent. I guess he was in ill health and for a while. And Bobby Ray Inman actually found out after Israel bombed the nuclear facility in Iraq. He determined that they were getting fed all this information by the CIA. So he limited the information that it would go to them to only those things that took place within 250 miles of Israel. They shouldn't be getting things that go around on in the entire world, which I guess they were before. And, of course, this made the Israel and the Israel lobby and Bill Sapphire of the New York Times took the lead in destroying Bobby Ray Inman. And, of course, Bobby Ray Inman came out and said there was a conspiracy against him, and then the New York Times said he was going crazy.
Well,
sort of like James Forrestal had that same problem.
Before jumping, yes.
Yes, before he fell out the window.
Actually, Sapphire also led the attack against George Bush Sr. after he refused to let Israel get $10 billion in loan guarantees.
Yes, he played a role in that one, too. Yes, he was a significant role. His move to the next world has been cut back some, though they found many. They found enough people to replace him.
Unfortunately, they did. Actually, the Strobe-Talbott piece that I mentioned, I believe, recall, was written in response to Israel's attack on the Iraqi reactor, which coincided with Reagan's first trip to Europe and took that trip to Europe off the headlines. If my memory serves me right, and it was like Talbot was trying to look at U.S. strategic interest around the globe. He was a Russian expert, and so this was the basis of his criticism. And there was other criticism, actually, of Israel about that time for doing that. George Bush Sr., as Moshe Aarons recalled in his book, George Bush Sr. wanted to sanction Israel for bombing the reactor. But he was outvoted by Reagan and Alexander Haig, who was there at the time. Your 2008 book, Transparent Cabal, one of the best investigations into the world and mind of the neocons. There were some critics who thought the neocons were simply a component of the Bush Republican establishment and stopped paying attention to them. Noam Chomsky, I don't think he's ever mentioned them. But from what I've seen, they're alive and well. And that's not, of course, referring to their state of mind. Let's say they seem to be thriving.
They do. They seem to, you know, they were surrounding Mitt Romney, and they've now taken the lead in trying to defeat Hegel, and they perhaps haven't quite succeeded in eliminating him, but they've certainly, as you pointed out, made it difficult for him, and it will be difficult for him to operate as Secretary of Defense. So, you know, they're right out in the center there, and they were able to raise a considerable amount of money to try to defeat Hegel. All these, not simply Emergency Committee for Israel, which Bill Kristol helped to set up. Now, Professor Finkelstein believes that the neocons are not supportive of Israel, but my feeling would be that title would seem to give them away a little bit, Emergency Committee for Israel, which I think Bill Kristol said is the pro-Israel wing of the pro-Israel community. So they're still there. They really are pro-Israel. I don't know what more they have to do to, indicate it. And they haven't gone away. I know Justin Raimondo thinks they've been defeated with the Hegel getting by the committee there, but that's definitely not the case. I think they showed their great power in what they could actually do.
No, it's extraordinary. I mean, I grew up during the McCarthy period. I remember HUAC and Joe McCarthy and Ted Cruz of Texas with a 5 o'clock show. Looks just like Joe McCarthy. One of the people, the characters who emerged as one of the leading attackers of Hegel was Elliot Abrams, who actually accused him on NPR of being anti-Semitic. And this seemed to actually go too far. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, my grandfather used to have a saying about the relationship between Israel and the United States, and he always used to say that the tail wags the dog.
That's what a number of people say.
Yes, and I'm also curious why it is that the House of Representatives or members of the House of Representatives, and especially our 2nd District new representative, Jared Huffman, hasn't come out and been more vocal in support of Chuck Hagel.
A good question. You might want to call his office and ask him.
One other thing, and I'll get off the
yes.
air. And I'm not sure if many people remember this, but in 1968, the Israelis attacked the USS Liberty.
67,
excuse me. In the Suez, or the Gulf of Suez.
No, it was actually offshore, off the coast of Egypt and Israel.
So it was in the Mediterranean.
Yes.
And not many people bring that up, especially all these so-called patriots who make up the Republican leadership.
John McCain's father, Admiral McCain, was one of the people who was responsible for covering up the attack.
Well, it was a travesty, and while I support an alliance with Israel, I do think that their lobbying in this country is just, or shall I say, the support they receive from our legislators is treasonous.
Well, it's a point I've made on this program a number of times. Stephen, you have some comment on that?
Well, you know, of course.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Of course, the attack on the Liberty is one of those these semi-taboos. It's not career-enhancing to go over it. That yes, it looks like Israel knew what they were doing when they wanted to knock out the Liberty, which was an intelligence gathering ship, and was picking up some information that they didn't want them to have. And the attack apparently looks to be the effort was to knock out the Liberty, escape, everybody'd be dead, and it would appear to have been, the claim could have been, it was done by Egypt or something, since this was during the 67 war. But sailors on the Liberty fought a little too hard and were able to fight them off, and one have tried to tell their story, but of course, they're just, when they try to mention what they believe happened, which puts the blame on Israel, they are blamed to be, they are perceived or argued to be extreme anti-Semites.
Exactly. And
sort of like Hegel.
It's one of the travesties, and unfortunately, the solidarity movement around the Palestinians has ignored it as much as has our U.S. Congress. And one thing before I go to the next caller, just a couple calls, is that when it was unknown who was doing the attacking, Admiral Geis, who the Sixth Fleet, called for air support to be sent out to the Liberty. And when they found it was Israeli, McNamara, Defense Secretary, quote, at the time, recalled the planes. And when Admiral Geis wanted to make sure he knew what he was doing, Lyndon Johnson came on the telephone and said, "I don't want to embarrass an ally." Some ally. Anyway, let's go to the phones here. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Fascinating show, as always. Let me point out that at the same time this business with Hegel was happening, we had the incident at Brooklyn College going on, where people who are representing the boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign were going to do a seminar, just a seminar, and there was an unbelievable tsunami of outrage by various representatives in New York and calling the campus administrators anti-Semitic and, you know, what we're seeing here is a soft form of McCarthyism around this. But at the same time, I am optimistically seeing that among the general public, there does seem to be a very slowly recognition, that growing recognition, that this lockstep, uncritical support for Israeli policies is ultimately not doing us that very good a thing in the Middle East. So I'm optimistic in that sense. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Do you have a comment on that, Stephen?
I'm not so optimistic that people, you know, I think there's many people who do sort of see it, regular folks, but it's not a pressing issue for them compared to the Israel lobby, where it is the one issue. I believe Mr. Adelson also seems to treat that as his one fundamental issue and is willing to spend millions of dollars on it. So it doesn't count too much in the political realm, since it's not the main issue we vote on. If we were sort of a direct democracy like 5th century Athens or something, and we voted on every move, maybe Israel wouldn't do that well, but that's not the way our representative democracy is set up.
Well said. Well, let's go to another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, just a quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. Is it true that America is a puppet for Israel financially? Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't say America's a puppet or controlled, because, of course, America doesn't do exactly what, you know, we're not doing exactly what, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu wants us to do right now. But Israel is very, very influential, and especially sort of dominates things completely regarding the relationship with the Palestinians. On the overall, America's overall Middle East policy, it has become more influential, but it doesn't really control overall American foreign policy toward the Middle East, because if it did, we would have bombed Iran some years ago.
Right. It's almost like Stephen Green wrote years ago, what it establishes that they have certain parameters they've established in which an American president can make policy within those parameters. So we have sanctions against Iran, which we have pushed, and we will sanction any country that doesn't obey those sanctions. I mean, so
it's affecting, Israel's affecting everything to the detriment of United States interest. I mean, even, you know, not from a non-interventionist or pacifist or left-wing critic of American imperialism, from the American imperialist position is being detrimentally affected. I remember, I think Gabriel Colco one time said, well, that was a good thing.
I don't know. There's time for one more quick question. Hello, you're on It Takes on the World. Quick question or comment.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest thinks that Palestine has gotten more support internationally from its recognition through the United Nations.
Good question.
I'll take my answer off
the
air.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think there's more recognition, you know, for the Palestinians around the world, but it doesn't seem to, because the United States is there, and especially that it has a veto in the UN Security Council, which enables it to prevent any strong sanctions from being opposed on Israel. It doesn't matter too much if, you know, 190 countries, 190-4 vote for something in the General Assembly, some measure against Israel. It doesn't really matter, because the United States can stop anything.
And on that measure, we have to come to the end of the hour on that depressing truth, home truth. Stephen Zagoski, thanks so much for being our guest again today on Takes on the World. It's been too long. We have to do it again.
Yes, I'd like to be back again. And can I mention once again,
yes,
the Transparent Cabal? It's almost, the hardback issue is almost sold out, but there's now, you know, you can get e-books with it there. So if you're interested in the Israeli neocon angle on the war in Iraq, but it also covers overall American Middle East policy through 2008.
I recommend it.
Okay, thank you very much.